from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
And good evening from wherever you are listening to us. This is Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. And tonight we have, I think, one of the most important shows that we've done. And we've done a lot of important shows. But tonight we are going to be talking about the Parkland and Pulse survivors and the fight against gun violence. Ironically, a lot of that fight and a lot of the voices, and I would say some of the strongest voices that are taking hold right now against the gun violence that has plagued this country are actually LGBTQ voices. And I don't think it's a mistake that that's the case. Case in point, one of the huge incidents that happened was the Pulse nightclub. And tonight we have a very, very special young man on who survived that. Brandon Wolf will be our special guest. But Brandon is also working with the Parkland school survivors. And of those survivors, a couple of them are LGBTQ and have really, I think, because of that experience and because of their leadership in that way, have naturally morphed into being able to stand up for this cause. And this is a game changer. This is going to change our society. I really believe that, and it is way, way past time for that to happen. Before we get into that, we do want to go to our incredibly trusted newsman and the LGBTQ news for the week. Good evening, Brody Levesque.
Good evening, Rob, and good evening to all of you. Headline news for Thursday, March the 1st, 2018. Scandal in Wilmington, Ohio, where the mother of a high school freshman is accusing her son's wrestling coach of outing him as transgender. Aiden Paul Krabacher has been transitioning since he was in the sixth grade, and his mother told reporters he's approximately 70% through that process. Paul Krabacher was never questioned about joining the boys' wrestling team, according to his mother. But the local Fox affiliate reports that the high school coach, Kelly Tolliver, went on to belittle the teen and forced him to change in the girls' locker room. Coach Tolliver allegedly insisted that the young man was a girl in front of the entire team. Pokerbacher's mother told a Wilmington school board meeting, quote, "Not only did Coach Tolliver announce to the entire team that Aiden is transgender, he publicly humiliated him in front of his classmates with privileged medical information he had no business sharing. While the school district is investigating the claims made against Tolliver, it has yet to take any action against him." The young wrestler has since quit the team. The true star of the 2018 Winter Olympics was Team USA's first openly gay figure skater, Adam Rippon. While the games might be over, Rippon is using his platform to talk about the issues that matter and his love life. Rippon appeared on the Ellis DeGeneres Show in his first interview since returning to the U.S. from South Korea. He walked onto Ellen's show wearing his bronze medal, which he earned with his teammates in the figure skating team event. When Ellen asked the skater about his recent involvement with the youth engagement program at GLAAD, Rippon said, "We're getting these kids and they're becoming activists in their community. When I was young, to have had someone to out there to look up to would have made a world of difference. It would have changed my life." He also added that today, 1 in 5 kids identify as LGBTQ, telling Ellen's audience, "So look to your left, look to your right, and if no one is gay, you're probably the one." In Washington, the White House hosted an opiate summit today, and President Trump talked about the U.S. adopting stricter penalties for people who illegally distribute drugs, including capital punishment. Trump said, and I quote, "Some countries have the ultimate penalty, and then they have much less of a drug problem than we do." Then he added, "If you shoot one person, they give you the death penalty. These people can kill 2,000, 3,000 people, and nothing happens to them." Also in Washington today, Senate Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that no gun-related legislation would come up next week, including the narrow bipartisan proposal that would attempt to shore up the national instant background check system. Based on multiple sources tonight, NBC News is reporting that the National Security Advisor to President Trump, U.S. Army Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, will be relieved of his position within the administration. In response, the White House said that there would be, again, no personnel announcements at this time. However, the White House did not specifically mention McMaster. Finally, in a statement released on Twitter, the United States Ambassador to Mexico, Roberta Jacobson, wrote that she will step down from her post in May, tweeting, quote, "It has been an honor and a privilege to serve my country as ambassador to Mexico." Jacobson was nominated by President Barack Obama, and the New York Times reports that the Trump administration already has someone in mind to replace her. You might even say the writing is on the wall. Back to you, Rob.
Thank you, Brody. Brody, before we move to our special guest tonight, I did want to talk to you about a couple of things, because the issue that we're talking about, the gun violence, is
right
near and dear to both our hearts. We've both been in the trenches on this for a while. And I even hearken this back to the AIDS epidemic where, and I know you and I both went through that in our experience, where we were losing loved ones left and right, and we were in a power grid where no one was doing anything about it, or significantly little about it. And that huge frustration of watching people die in your sphere while up above the power grid was ignoring it. But after that, I know for me personally, I wasn't there for any of these, but I was affected deeply by the Newton shooting, being a gay dad with two kids who were just relatively around the same age of the kids being shot. And at that time, you were one of the senior editors over at LGBTQ Nation. And I wrote a piece about Newton, even though it had no LGBT-specific information in it. And you guys were the ones that published it. I was also writing for Huffington Post at that time, and they chose not to publish it because it seemed like it was too much of an outside issue for them, where a gay dad was making my feelings known about this gun violence. And then Pulse happened, which is obviously deep for all of us, especially for Brandon, who was our guest. But those of us who aren't there, who understand the idea of being in a safe LGBTQ space and having it so violently violated, and the horror that was around that. And now for me, being a gay dad of 15-year-olds in a high school where this happened, again, incredibly close to home. But you've started one, and this is my long-winded way of coming around to a question for you. You were at Columbine. You saw the very beginnings of this. What do you remember of that, and what was your thoughts at that time, and did you think then that it would just be allowed to continue for decades after that?
No, truthfully, I didn't. We were on the ground in Littleton, Colorado, reporting. I had arrived approximately 12 hours into the incident. It was inconceivable, not only to myself, but I think other journalists who were there, that this sort of thing could happen. And of course, what made it worse was the fact that the shooters were two kids from the student body, which they were part of a more marginalized segment. And as we've gone forward with all of these shootings, we're beginning to discover that there's a pattern, and the pattern is always the same. Even with the Pulse shooting, that shooter probably fit within some of the parameters of the model of the shooters that we're seeing. They're socially outcast. Some of them have mental health challenges, others undiagnosed mental health challenges. They've been bullied. LGBTQ Nation was one of the first news outlets that was doing an immediate response to the shooting of then Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, and in due part to the fact that one of her aides, Daniel Hernandez, happened to be gay, and we started covering what was going on. And again, that shooter in that instance with the Congresswoman, it was the same scenario. I think by the time we got to Newtown, Connecticut, and the shooting at Sandy Hook, and we're talking babies, the assumption was that, you know, this could not continue. It just simply couldn't go on. But not only could it go on, it after every instance, everything escalated. The NRA's rhetoric escalated, the proliferation of that particular kind of weapon escalated, with the exception of Congresswoman Giffords, who was, in fact, shot with, you know, a single-caliber handgun. But these other incidences was military hardware. And honestly, I think all of us in the press corps really felt that there was at some point there had to be the breaking point. And then after Newtown and after there was virtually no reaction at all whatsoever, except for the thoughts and prayers, you know, and then Pulse, which was just, that was horrid. I can't begin to, that just was, and Brandon can go on that, but that was horrible. And now here we are. And the kids at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. And I think the major difference is these kids have finally said, you know what, no. You know, we're drawing the line in the sand and we're going to do something. And interestingly enough, I think it really took these kids with their messaging to be able to do that. And, of course, Brandon's going to tell us a lot more about those incredible, amazing adolescents. But Rob, I didn't. I think after Columbine, we really assumed that, you know, there would be, you know, a breaking point here. And I've got to be honest with you. It just, as a parent myself, you know, so I don't know. I as a member of the press and as a parent, I this whole aberrant thing about this obsession with military hardware is just, I just don't understand it, honestly.
Yeah, I am right with you, and I really want to thank you for what you just gave us. You, that overview was intense and incredible, and I'm very glad I asked the question because you were eloquent and wonderful in your response. It is my honor, actually, to bring on to the show now Brandon Wolf. Brandon was actually at Pulse, and as he will tell us, lost two of his best friends there, which I can't even imagine that horror, and we will be asking him about it. But he is the character of a phoenix. He has risen from the ashes to turn it into an effort to heal our country, to get behind efforts to make this better, make the problem go away. He was a surrogate on multiple political campaigns in the 2016 cycle and appeared in July at the Democratic National Convention. He also serves as vice president of the Drew Project, a nonprofit organization that establishes gay-straight alliances in public high schools. And as Brody alluded to, he has also been a mentor to some of the Parkland shooting victims and helping them find their voices. So without further ado, Brandon, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you guys for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for joining us. Yeah. the gratitude is all on us. So Brandon, I know you have probably told this story 1,000 times, but if you don't mind once more, what happened that night at Pulse for you?
Yeah, it was a weird night for us to be out. I'll be really honest with you that Saturdays were not my thing. If you've ever lived in Orlando or spent time in Orlando, Saturday is not exactly the hottest night to go out. We typically did our thing on Friday. Saturday was recovery. And then Sunday we'd find ourselves out for brunch. But I had just recently separated from my boyfriend. And like any good young gay, I was obsessed with him. So when he called me and asked if I'd like to go out that night, I said, yes, of course. And then as I hung up the phone, I realized, wow, that means I'm going to be alone with this person in a club, and that doesn't feel very comfortable. So I sent a message to my very best friends, Drew and Juan, who just happened to live two doors down from me as well. We kind of lived in a little Melrose Placey kind of apartment complex. And I said, hey, I'm calling in backup. I really need your support on this. I can't be out alone with this kid, but I'm really infatuated with him, so I think I need a little help. And like the incredible friends they were, of course, they said yes. We got ourselves together. We met at my place for a few drinks, and then we got in the car and we went to Pulse. And I can distinctly remember that it was really busy that night. You know, again, it really wasn't our thing to go on Saturday. I'm not certain if it was usually that busy, but it was wall to wall people. Tensions were high with my ex and I, and I was determined, I think, to make it through that night at least cordial with everyone around me. Right. But Drew was a clinical psychologist, and he also knew me really, really well. And so he could sense my discomfort. And about midway through the night, probably 1 o'clock, 1:30, he said, we need to go to the patio and have a conversation. So he dragged the four of us all outside, and he and Juan split my ex and I up, and we each went to a corner of the patio, and they gave us the same lecture. They said, why do you let things get in the way of love? Why don't you just let it be what it's going to be? Why don't you stop focusing on the silly stuff and just fall in love? And after they each did their lecture, Drew gathered us in a little circle, and he had these long, kind of lanky, goofy arms, and he put them around our shoulders, and he said, you know what we never say enough is that we love each other. And so we went around the circle and we said, I love you. And I didn't know at the time, it's almost as if he knew, but I didn't realize that would be our last conversation together. So we went inside, we continued to dance. And then right around 2 o'clock in the morning, my ex and I decided we were going to use the bathroom and then we would be ready to go. We were there in the bathroom in front of a stall when the first shots were fired. And I remember this sense of confusion. Not really knowing what was going on, but it felt eerie. Something felt not right. And then it was just a couple seconds after that that about a dozen people came running into the bathroom, and they all had this look on their faces. I've never seen it before. I had never seen it before at that time, but I knew exactly what it meant. It meant that something really bad was happening, and I can remember them in this state of panic, wondering whether we should run or whether we should hide or what we should do. And that's when the second round of shooting started, and it was relentless. It was just a bang, 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 bang. And as it accelerated and the smell of blood and gun smoke filled the bathroom, we made a decision that we needed to run. There wasn't anywhere to hide. So my ex and I linked arms with a few people and ran for the nearest exit. We were lucky enough to get out. I could barely see. As we were running from the bathroom, the club was so full of smoke. And when we got outside, this is the moment I think that I will never, ever, ever forget for the rest of my life. We got outside. We were halfway down the block, and it was like I had run into a wall. Something came over me, a weight came over me, and I fell to my knees on the sidewalk. And my ex said, we really got to go. We got to move. We can't stay here. And I just looked up at him with these huge eyes full of tears. And the only thing that I could say out loud was, oh, my God, they're still there. And I tried to go back. I tried to turn around. And by then, the police were there. They wouldn't let us back in. But I will just never forget that moment on the sidewalk, realizing that I would never get to say goodbye. I would never get to hug my friends. There would never be another birthday again. I think that all flashed in front of my eyes at that moment.
Oh my God, I can't even put words to that. That's enormous. So, what shifting it from that horrible personal tragedy months later, year later, what made you focus on the specifics of guns and the bigger picture? Because obviously this was incredibly personal. And for many people, and this is what's kind of unique about this situation, many people are so caught in, for completely understandable reasons, that personal tragedy, that the idea of I'm going to fight against gun violence is sort of way out there as a priority. How did that become in focus for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think everybody heals in their own way, right? And pain is very unique to everyone. And I certainly do not knock or judge anyone for going through their own healing process. I know for some that means writing. For some that means music. For some that means trying to forget it ever happened, going to a therapist, changing cities. I've kind of seen the whole spectrum. For me, healing is about keeping the very best things about Drew and Juan alive. And the thing that I loved most about Drew was his boundless optimism and his conviction that the world could be better tomorrow than it is today. I can remember, you know, in the beginning of the 2016 primary season, he was staunchly Hillary and I was absolutely Bernie bro, 100%. I'm like, listen, the world is no more complicated than some people make too much money and other people don't. And I don't know why you have to make it any more complex than that, right? And he's the one who's, hey, it's measured. We've got to take a solid approach to it. It's a lot more complicated than you understand. And in those fierce debates, I can remember him still having that conviction that regardless if it was a tiny change, regardless if it took 100 years, is this idea that the world could be better tomorrow than it was today. So as we got further and further removed from Pulse, I think what I was most afraid of was that we would lose that part of Drew, that the world would never get to learn the things that I loved about him, and that sense of optimism might fade. So the first kind of activity, I guess, or offer that I got was to work with the Pride Fund to End Gun Violence, which was started right after Pulse and is based in D.C. And I was so thankful for them to offer me a role in their advisory board so that I could give my thoughts and opinions and speak out about gun violence. And as I started to do that, as I started to take on those qualities that Drew had that I loved so much, I suddenly realized that I had an opportunity to share the best parts of him with the entire world. And that with this platform, the whole world could know the Drew that I knew so well. And so I think that's probably why I have become so passionate about it. That's why it's so personal to me, because everything that I do, everything I say, every event I attend, I feel like I'm doing it for him, and that it's keeping the best parts of him alive. So I think that's why it's so personal to me.
Man, that is so inspirational. I love that. So, Brandon, you have gotten involved, obviously, with establishing gay-straight alliances in public high schools. That's a cause that's very near and dear to my heart. Like I said, I have two teenage sons, and out here in Santa Cruz, I work with the Queer Youth Awards, which is a 20-year-old award ceremony that and wow. GSAs are all very much part of our culture here. So being in that effort, when the Parkland event shooting happened, what was your reaction?
Well, my first reaction was hopelessness, because if I feel a sense of obligation to protect people from that pain that I felt. And so when I turned on the news and I saw that it had happened again, and this time again to children, I can't even tell you the heartbreak and hopelessness that I felt. And I didn't know how to deal with it, really. And then something changed. It was almost overnight, really, that I was watching this coverage, and what I saw was Drew. I saw that same boundless optimism. I felt that same hope, that passion, that drive, that belief that the world could be better. And this time it was coming from teenagers. And not just teenagers, but teenagers who had gone through the worst possible pain, worse than anyone can possibly imagine, trauma like you can't believe. And yet here they were 24 hours later on national television demanding that we do something to protect them. And so almost overnight, this sense of hopelessness gave way to a new sense of optimism. And I was reminded again, this best parts that I loved about Drew, because it was alive in these kids. And I really haven't lost that since then. I think every single day, even on the ones that get me down a little bit, the teenagers, the students from Parkland are always the first ones to lift me up and remind me that we're on a long journey. We have an obligation to make the world a better place, a safer place, and we truly are kind of that family that's in it together.
Well, I think looking at, you know, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas kids, Brandon, you probably agree that the Eagles are definitely soaring. I think that one of the things to me as a journalist that stands out is how articulate they are. Their arguments are well-formed. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Cameron, he will take on a United States senator and not back off. He was not touted.
And you know what?
Thank
God for that, too, because somebody had to stand up to Marco Rubio and tell him to shut the hell up, because I've been meaning to do it, but he won't meet with me in person. So I am like, thank you, God, for Cameron.
Well, let's walk right down that one. Okay, so we've got this brilliant photograph of you, and you're standing there in a very Black Power pose, from echoing the Civil Rights Movement, which I think is just completely awesome. But what's really interesting to me is behind you is the virtually thousands of adolescents and their parents and everyone. I think this is what at the State Capitol building there in Tallahassee. And how did you feel about the messaging with these kids, and what were you really hoping that they'd be able to accomplish? I know there were some discussions at first that Florida Governor Rick Florida Governor Rick Scott, that was a Freudian slip, would not meet with you all. And of course there were members. And then of course the worst part was when the Florida House sat there and voted down the gun thing and then turned around and said, yeah, well, porn is bad for you. Walk us through that, would you?
Yeah, I think, again, so I met these Parkland students the day before that, and we were at a candlelight vigil in Tallahassee, and I had gone to show my support, but I didn't really know what it would look like, to be honest with you. So I got there, I did my thing, I got out my candle, and somebody was helping me light it, and it was in that moment, there at the vigil with these kids, that I realized I hadn't been to a candlelight vigil since Pulse, since that day in front of the Dr. Phillips Center. And I can still remember Drew and Juan's photos in the grass. And it just washed over me, and I started to cry. And, you know, immediately I took myself to the back of the room, because it's not about me. Today is not about me. It's about these kids. And so I tried to get out of the way. And a lawmaker came up to me afterward and said, you know, hey, I know you're upset, I know you're emotional, but I really need you to talk to these kids. Somebody who knows what they're feeling has to tell them that it's going to be okay. Pulled on my big boy pants, and I got myself together, and I said, I'm going to go over there, and I'm going to advise them, and I'm going to be the leader, and I'm going to tell them it's all going to be great. And I went over, and, you know, the funniest thing happened. All those kids gathered around me in a circle and gave me the world's biggest hug. And I think in that moment, I realized that I needed them so much more than they needed me. And it was almost like they completed me. So when we got to the Capitol, I think what you might have expected to see was, you know, leading the charge and here come the students behind me. It was nothing like that. Every bit of that moment was about those students standing on that stage, ushering in a new generation of leaders. And, you know, when asked to give them advice, the only thing I could think to tell them was, I am so proud of you. And let me tell you this, I serve no purpose other than to move people out of your way. And if somebody tries something with you, they have to go through me first. And I sincerely believe that that's our relationship. That's our relationship as a survivor family. That's going to be our relationship for the rest of our lives. These students, these teenagers, are the future. And, you know, regardless of whether or not these old Republican white guys are going to show up and do their part is kind of irrelevant to me, because this is the last gasp, right, of their generation of legislators. The future is in these teenagers, and it looks so different. It looks so hopeful, and it's so beautiful that all I hoped for was that they would get on that stage and in front of all those thousands of people give a big middle finger to the generation of lawmakers in the building behind us and rally those thousands of young people to the polls at the midterm.
I think you're
Brendan,
right. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah. I just wanted to say, I've been in a lot of recovery situations, and I just want to suggest one thing to you. I love your point of view on this, and I love what happened with them giving you a hug and everything else. The one thing I do want to suggest to you is that your presence, you standing as a survivor to them, I wasn't there, you were, you know what's going on, but I'm going to surmise that them seeing you standing, having survived and having been through what they are without saying a word, that was what you did. That was your inspiration. And I love that it was a give and take, but I don't want to underestimate, I think, what your presence to these kids and to all of us, of you standing up, what that really means, because I do think it's significant.
I appreciate that. And I certainly don't underestimate how powerful that is, especially for them, right? Because they don't know what they're going to deal with. They don't know what it's going to feel like. They're only days removed from a situation like that. So for them to see someone who's been in the same situation, is powerful. It's soothing, it's relieving. But I think what was so impactful to me was the same way that Drew was my savior so many years ago, so were they. And I felt that same sense of compassion and hope from them. And I'm so proud to call them friends for the rest of my life.
Well,
I think that's incredible.
About these kids, the interesting thing that I find about these kids, and I have interviewed David Hogg and a couple of the others, is their absolute laser focus on accomplishing the mission. Their exit strategy here is to get military weaponry completely off the streets, and they're not attacking, you know, the Second Amendment. They're not attacking, you know, these things that the right has always been, you know, embracing, and that's always been the third rail of the political thing. They're not going there. What they're saying is, we don't need to be in a position where we can't go to school because we're fearful some moron is going to take military-grade weaponry and kill us. This is unacceptable.
Yeah.
And and the interesting thing is, and in David's case particularly, because he has been horribly attacked by the conspiracy theorists and the people on the right, the Alex Jones of the world, but he keeps coming back and he keeps hammering away at them. Talk to me a little bit about the dedication. You know, you had some time with the kids in Tallahassee. I mean, what do you think the real motivation here is? Because I am in awe of these teenagers. I really seriously am.
I love that this generation of youth, and specifically this group of teenagers, is so unafraid of what's out there. And I think that comes from a lot of things. I think they're part of a generation that is ultra connected through social media. So they're not afraid of the big, bad, scary world out there because they've been exposed to it for so long. And then I think on top of that, they're from the generation that's been blasted for getting participation trophies and being apathetic and self-absorbed. But the reality is they're fiercely independent. And they've been kind of forced to be so. Unlike other generations, you know, a lot of times both parents are working and they're involved in extracurricular activities because you got to have 14 clubs and 5 titles under your name to even get into college anymore. So they end up being fiercely independent and almost adult-like at such a younger age. And on top of that, they just don't give a damn about the NRA or Republican lawmakers or all the other things that seem to scare off the conversation in the past. They don't care. You look at Emma Gonzalez, for example. She put together over 1 million Twitter followers in a week. She put together more Twitter followers in 9 days than the NRA has in their entire existence. She is unashamed
I know,
and unafraid, and she has a bigger audience than they do. So what I love about it is just their relentlessness and their lack of fear, right? They're unashamed, they're unafraid, and it shows because for once in the conversation, it's been decades we've been having this conversation, and for once, the NRA and the Republicans can't do anything about it. They can't figure out how to play on the same field as these teenagers armed with iPhones. They can't figure out how to use social media to their advantage, and you're seeing that show up. The teenagers are unafraid. They don't care. They have a message to share with the world. They want to ensure that no other school goes through what they did. And the people on the other side just can't even figure out how to get their shit together.
Yeah, amazing. Brandon, you talked about meeting with your relationship with the kids. What are some stories you've heard from them? You shared tonight your story about Drew and Juan, which was incredibly moving. What are some things of their experiences that you've heard that have touched you similarly?
Oh, my gosh. I had a moment the other day where I think it was Emma. She posted some stuff. They found a camera roll, a roll of photos from the day of the shooting. And it was beautiful to see them at lunch, to see them, you know, in the courtyard, to see them in the classroom. It was Valentine's Day, so there was lots of pink and red and hearts and so carefree. You could just feel the weight off of their shoulders in these photos. And it wasn't even a story that they told. I think it was just seeing them as they were before this shooting, seeing them as they were before their innocence was ripped away, that was most touching to me. And I just, in that moment, I not only felt more connected to each of them, but I also so wished that I could bring that back to them, because I know what it feels like to be going through life, to be innocent, to be naive, to be kind of complacent, and then to have that all stripped away from you in an instant. So I just love taking a peek into that day before it all happened and the true, real selves that they were.
I think that that's a really valid point, Brandon, because it is a case of innocence lost. And I think that it is also one of those scenarios, and this is why I love the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Eagles so much, is that they're saying no one else should have to be forced to lose, you know, their innocence. And although this whole thing should have been resolved after Newtown and the Sandy Hook Elementary killing, it wasn't. Let's talk a little bit about Emma and David and Cameron and Lynn and Tanya and the rest and March for Our Lives. On March 24th, 2018, they are going to be getting together in Washington. I've talked to my friends at the National Park Service. The U.S. Park Police are saying that 500,000 is probably a real conservative number based on some of the inquiries they've been getting. This is going to be an important day. Is this message aimed at the lawmakers and the Republicans who, let's face it, are a little on the clueless side of life? Or is this really aimed at the NRA and their supporters, the gun manufacturers and the lobbyists, and saying, no, we're done. You're finished. Your day in the sun is over with. Do you think that that will be something that comes out of that?
You know, I think it's a warning to both. I think you've got a message to a couple of groups of people. I think, first of all, you've got the NRA and the crosshairs, right? Finally, a group of people is standing up to them who's unafraid of the result. Emma and David and Cameron, they don't need the NRA's money to get them elected, right, because they're not politicians. So they can take to the streets and say, you know what, I don't care. We're here to tell you that you don't belong in politics anymore. So I think you're going to hear some of that. I will, you know, be rocking my no NRA money T-shirt, of course. But on top of that, I think what you're going to hear is a call to action to young people. You know, a really powerful moment for me at the Capitol was one of the representatives asked the crowd, and the estimation is that there was about 10,000 people there in Tallahassee. And he asked this crowd of 10,000, he said, how many of you are under 30 years old? And about 90% of that crowd raised their hand. And he said, well, I'll tell you statistically, people under 30 don't vote. We know that. That's statistics. People under 30 simply don't vote. He said, now asking this question, how many of you are going to vote in the midterms this year? The same 90% raised their hand. I think you're going to hear that same call to action in D.C. I think you're going to hear it in the sister marches around this country. Because if young people mobilize and say enough is enough, we have to live with the shitstorm you're putting us through, and they vote people out and put people in who will do the right thing, you will see change in this country. I heard it said really well, and I can't remember who told me, but he said, what if all along we've had it wrong? What if gun safety legislation was never a partisan issue? It was always a generational issue. And I think that's really poignant because this group of students, this generation of kids, is the mass shooting generation. They've had to live with it from day one. They don't know any other world. And quite frankly, I think they're sick and tired of it. They're tired of being told there's nothing we can do. They're tired of being told the issue is too complicated. They're tired of being told that the Second Amendment trumps their right to live and live freely. And so I think what you're going to hear in Washington, D.C. is not just a rebuke of the NRA and its nonsensical messaging, but I think you're also going to hear a call to arms, a call to action for young people to get out to the polls and make their voices heard in terms of votes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually had a follow-up question, but I think you've almost answered it, but I'm going to ask it anyway. That was brilliant,
by the way.
It's like
you sent me the key first. I'm Hillary Clinton. You sent me the questions first.
But we didn't. No, Donna Brazile on the side. No, sorry about that. But, no, it's because locally – there's also a rumbling of the march locally in California here. And I've already told my sons that when they're at school, you know, I will back them 100% for them to walk out of class at that time, on that day. You know, and I'm going to let their teachers know that as well. But what I really wanted to hear was, and you already alluded to part of it, but for those around the country who are thinking about marching and getting out there, if this was your bully pulpit to talk to them right this minute, to get them ready for that, what would your message be?
My message is get the hell out and march. And let your march be not just a march because you feel like getting your steps in, but let it be a march toward the polls this year. Let it be a march toward the midterm. Let it be a motivating factor. Let it be a turning point in American history that young people, that people in this country are tired of letting a sliver of a minority direct things based on old world policies, based on things that don't make any sense anymore. Listen, we saw what happened in 2016. I was a surrogate for Hillary Clinton. I was personally crushed. It was the first time I've ever been ultra involved in a campaign. And what kills me is that if people in this country actually voted, we would not have the bloated buffoon that we do in the White House. And I think I thought that would be a wake-up call, but I was concerned. I was concerned that we wouldn't have learned our lesson, that we would make the same mistakes in the midterms and then again in 2020. But I am more convinced than ever that we've finally started to find our stride. When is the last time that people went to the polls to vote on gun safety legislation that were not on the conservative side of the aisle? It's just not a voting issue for anybody else. I think that now it is. I think that now we have ammunition in our back pocket where we can go to the booth, we can do something about it. A march doesn't have to be a march just to walk. It can be a walk to the voting booth. It can be a walk to the polls. Bring a friend, bring your grandma, bring your mom, bring your child, bring everybody you can, and remind them that the only way to really affect change in this country is to vote. I think that a lot of times the people in power forget who they work for. they get so wrapped up in the money and making change on their own dime and figuring out how to put a few more dollars in their campaign coffers that they forget that they work for us. I get it. I manage businesses. That's what I do for a living. And if somebody doesn't perform to their job function, I don't give them 5, 10, 15, 20 years worth of time to screw it up. I'm there on day one saying, listen, you're awesome, and this is not personal, but I really think this is not the job for you. It's time for me to find someone who can do it. I think it's beyond time for people in this country to march somewhere and tell the people in power that it's not personal, but I think it's time to find someone who can do that job.
I think one of the things that you just said that kind of resonated with me, when I first arrived in the United States from Canada, I arrived really early in the morning of May 21st, 1979. And then later on that evening, this was a very tense day in the city of San Francisco. They had handed down the verdict in the Moscone and Milk assassinations, and they basically let Supervisor White off with, you know, with what they did. And Cleve Jones, who I later got to know, was running around the Castro, literally, and he was he had Harvey's old bullhorn, and he was screaming out of the bars and into the streets, and of course that culminated in White Night riots. But hearing you say get out and march echoed and resonated with me, because I very much remember that it is, at least from the context for me as a journalist and as a historian, that kind of movement and that kind of moment, going back to these amazing kids. I think that, would you say that this would be their out of the bar and into the street moment for them, Brandon?
Yeah, I think, well, listen, yeah, it's out of the school, into the street. And that's what they want it to be. That's what they deserve. I've talked a little bit about every tragedy and group of survivors forms an identity. And, you know, you think about what happened after Pulse. And the message from Orlando became unity and acceptance and equality. And it was, you know, we talked a lot about the persecution of LGBT people. And if you go to Orlando today, it looks totally different than it did on June 12th, 2016, because back then there weren't rainbows everywhere. The whole city was not, you know, Orlando strong. That is something that has come out of the Pulse tragedy, is the sense of acceptance and inclusion. This tragedy's identity, Parkland's identity, is going to be change around gun legislation. I guarantee it. I think that this movement resonates with people. I think it's really hard if you're a lawmaker to look yourself in the mirror and explain why you can't make some change at all when you're faced with a group of teenagers that can't be called biased, they can't be leaning left, they're just kids who just went through the most horrific tragedy you can possibly imagine. It's hard to look in the mirror and tell yourself you can't do a damn thing, and that's what they've been doing for decades. So I think you're feeling this reckoning from the inside. And on the outside, you see an America, you see a country who is tired of inaction. They are tired of us saying we can't do anything about it, because that's simply not true. The majority of Americans support a lot of gun legislation. There is very little that we're ultra divided on. Did you know that a vast majority of Americans today support a ban on assault-style weapons? That's not a controversial issue in this country anymore. The only people telling us it's controversial are our lawmakers who are bought by the NRA. Those are the only two groups of people telling us it's controversial. So what I hope to see, and what I think you will see, is out of the schools, into the streets, and they're going to march on Washington. They're going to march all over this country to remind people that if our legislators won't do what's right, then we fire them and hire someone who will.
Brandon, I am completely awestruck and inspired by everything you're saying. I think it is, I mean, from your mouth to God's ear, And I'm not saying this in a light way. I hope to God that that is exactly what happened. I'm thinking even broader than the gun issue. You're absolutely right. Everything you've said in terms of, you know, the common sense of it. And it's even ironic to some of the things that are being discussed now in terms of some background checks and raising some age limits. And they're just like little tail wags to the big solutions that need to happen.
Mm.
You got me thinking, though, especially your comment about being a Hillary surrogate, in that one of the ironies is I live in California, and we did vote. And we voted to the point that not only did she win, we brought basically what would have been a popular majority to her win in the country,
yeah.
And still she lost. So there's yep. another system that defies common sense. It's legacy. It's archaic. It may be complex to change because it's protected by the Constitution, but it is broken. And yeah. I am hoping that the clarity that you're talking about in terms of this younger generation and gun violence spurs on to the other issues that really require obvious common sense. In terms of the Electoral College, in terms of climate change, in terms of all these things that are going to affect your future more than ours. I mean, you're going to be here longer, and nothing is being done on those either.
I hope so. I hope you're right, and I totally agree with you. You know, I was talking to somebody on Twitter, of all places, today, who's a Republican. And she said, I'm a Republican. I typically vote Republican. I saw the speech that you gave on the steps of the Capitol, and I want to know, how can I help? How can we come together? What can I do to make the world a safer place? Because this can't go on. I think you're going to see a lot more of that in younger generations. I think this idea of polarized partisan divide, you have to be one thing or another, it's black or it's white, isn't as prevalent in this generation and in the youth that we have today. You even look at, you know, because we're talking about LGBT issues, you look at gay clubs. I live in Tallahassee. There isn't a gay club. There is one club that has a gay night, and that's all we've got. And we've got a city of 300,000 people. And why is that? I've asked people, why in a college town with a major university, Florida State University, do we not have a gay club? And you know what they tell me? They tell me it's because we don't need one, because we feel that gay people and straight people don't have to go to different clubs, that gay people can just be gay at a club. Why can't they just be who they are? I think you're going to feel a lot more of that culture coming. I think that that's the wave that's coming. I think it's thanks to social media. I think people have been exposed to things for a lot longer than the previous generations have. And I think you're going to feel some of that partisan divide dissipate. I think that we have a generation coming that's going to be able to sit down at a table and say, we may not see 100% eye to eye, but 98% is a pretty damn good start.
Yeah, comment, because I know Brody's got a question, but I wanted to make one comment. In Santa Cruz, it is exactly the same way you just described. Major university with a queer center, huge queer population. The gay bar closed here, and now there's like a gay night somewhere. But you're exactly right. That is not a unique experience there. Brody?
Let's go back for a moment to my colleague Jake Tapper's town hall that saw Cameron and the father of the one young lady who was killed basically tag-teamed Senator Rubio, and it struck me that Senator Rubio was just astringent on all points. He obfuscated his position. He tried to twist it around, and I noticed that Cameron and a lot of the others, particularly the audience, weren't having it. Now, how much of a change of the dynamic of that is going to be able to be an effective drive in the political cycle as we start to move into these midterms? Because this is a critical point. We now have the Senate Majority Leader today announcing no gun anything. I'm pushing that off. It's off the table. It's off the agenda. We have the White House vacillating between grab all the guns to, well, we need to maybe raise the age limit. there seems to be an inconsistency there. It seems to me, and you've been with the kids and you've talked to them, that these kids aren't going to let that go. They're just going to, oh, hell no.
That's correct.
And, okay, so we will be seeing, I think, a greater movement as we get closer politically into the cycle for the midterms.
Yeah, I think, well, listen, let me not let this moment slip by to just say that Marco Rubio is trash. And the fact that Florida could reelect him at any given point is nonsense. I mean, listen, I know that we are probably the reason Donald Trump was elected, and I'm really sorry for that. I did my part. But Marco Rubio, there is no explanation for that because he has not done a thing for Floridians except take up space. I've had the displeasure of being in the same room as him, and he is every bit as bad as he seems on television times 10. So I just wanted to get that word in there. But what I think is important to remember is young people today, these Parkland survivors, aren't going anywhere. They're going to far outlive the people who are talking about no gun legislation today. Mitch McConnell doesn't have 50 or 60 years left in him to run the U.S. government. These Parkland survivors are the future. So I don't think it's any mistake that you're seeing, you know, a CNN town hall and a march on Tallahassee, and then a month later, a march on Washington, D.C., and a month after that, a school walkout. And then I'm sure a month after that, we're going to have another event. It is going to be relentless. It is going to be nonstop. They're going to trend on Twitter for the next 3, 4, 5 months. And I think you're going to see Republicans get through the primary where they have some fear of the right and the 5 or 6 evangelical Christians who somehow talk about wanting to blow everybody off the face of the earth, and you can be an adulterer, but I'm still an evangelical. Mm-hmm. They're going to get through that part, and then they're going to get into the general, and they're going to move left. We've seen it with Governor Scott. We've seen it a little bit with Marco Rubio. He can't figure out where he stands, but you're going to see Republicans forced to move left or be voted out of office.
All right. Well, that pretty much is an accurate summation of what some of the political pundits I've been talking to have said the same thing. Brandon, we only have a few minutes left, and before I throw it back to Rob, I just wanted to convey to you my deep and sincere appreciation to pass along to the Eagles at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. Mm. They're incredible kids, and we are MSD strong. So, Rob?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I want to echo that thanks to them. And, Brandon, I have to tell you, I mean, you are incredibly impressive. I absolutely adore you. You've been brilliant. You are brilliant. Everything you're doing is brilliant. And I don't say that lightly. I mean, you are a true hero, and as are the kids that you're working with. And I really believe in everything you said, and I believe in obviously what you're doing. And my commitment to carry that forward where I can out here, because I believe in you so much. And I just have to tell you on a personal note, I think Drew and Juan are so proud of you.
Thank you.
You have lived their legacy in a way that I think is beyond inspiring. As Brody said, we've only got a few seconds left. Any last words from you?
No, thank you so much for having me on tonight. I am proud, honored, humbled to be continuing to spread the best parts of Drew and Juan that I know, and also to stand alongside these Parkland survivors in their fight for what I think will be a better world tomorrow.
Well, thank you so much. And I want to thank Brody again, his brilliant journalism and everything else he does. And happy birthday, Brody, by the way.
Yeah, happy birthday. I was waiting for this moment to say happy birthday
there you
the
go.
Whole time.
There you go. Thanks, guys.
So, and I want to thank our listeners for listening. We will be back again next Thursday. Actually, next Thursday, we will be an hour earlier for an occasion, but we will be an hour earlier on here. But you can hear us every Thursday night. Also, in Santa Cruz, my show on Saturday nights, 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, www.ksco.com. Thank you. We love you. We're here for you. And we can't wait to talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.